Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Today, after the recent discovery of an invasive species, the Asian hornet, we ask, just how did it get here?
We have freight ferries coming in every day from France and Spain, especially now because of Brexit. So there's plenty of possibilities and opportunities for the Asian hornet to just hop on a ferry and arrive in Dublin or Cork or any port, really.
Researchers from University College Cork are asking you, our listeners, to become citizen scientists for their Common Lizard Survey.
They're very fascinating animals, the type of habitats you find them in. Firstly, you might not even think that you'd find lizards in areas like bogs, but they do actually do very well there. And then sand dune areas, they've got the vegetation that they need to provide the cover from predators, but also the food and areas where they need to hibernate. You'll also find them in stone walls, and believe it or not, some people are lucky enough to even have them in their gardens.
And as a pair of cranes are reported once again to be attempting to breed on bogland in the Midlands, Niall Hatch reminisces about the first time he encountered these beautiful birds.
As a child, one of my main birding memories, I was with my dad on holidays in France, and we went to a place in the middle of France, which is well known for this big migration of cranes coming down from Scandinavia, probably heading down to Iberia. This is the common crane, the one we're talking about here from the Bordenamona bogland. And I'd never seen them before, and I wanted to get them from my list. And it was a very cold, snowy day. We'd driven a long distance to come see them down from Paris, where my dad lived at the time. We went to this place where the guidebook said to go, a place called Lac du Der is the name of the place. And I couldn't see any. I was very disappointed. It was blowing a blizzard, and I just saw all these hedgerows, and I heard all of these school children making loads of noise. And it was several minutes later that I realized, when the blizzard cleared, that they weren't hedges, they were hundreds of cranes all standing in a row, and that they weren't school children, they were cranes all bugling and calling and greeting each other as they flew in, and it blew my mind.
Oh, what a wonderful sound those cranes are making there. Listen to that. Wouldn't it be terrific to think they might just breed again in the Midlands? I know they attempted last year and they're at it again this year. Who knows? We'll talk to the man from Bordenamona a little bit later on. But first, let's say hello to our panel and we'll start with Aina Nilana. How are you today, Aina?
I'm grand, Derek. Not a bother on me at all. Leppin' out of me skin, as usual.
Richard, how are things in Malahide?
Everything is fine in Malahide, Derek.
Not leppin' out of your skin or anything else for that matter?
Well, my lepping days are drawing to a close, Derek.
Anyway, last week at the end of the programme, Aina, I mentioned the Asian hornet because the National Parks and Wildlife Service and the National Biodiversity Data Centre put out an alert for the Asian hornet. And I thought, where's Aina when you need her? It came in at the end of the programme. Aina, tell us all about the Asian hornet, please.
Yes, indeed. This was quite a disturbing thing, really, because this Asian hornet was actually found in a house in North County Dublin. And the person who saw it knew it wasn't an ordinary jumped up wasp on steroids, took a picture of it and sent it in to the National Parks and Wildlife Service and kept the creature. And it was dying, and I presume it subsequently died. And it was actually identified properly by an expert in the National Museum who has the insect in the reference collection there. So it was no figment of nobody's imagination. So this hornet, of course, is a huge thing relative. It's a wasp, essentially. It's a wasp. And wasps in Ireland, or ordinary old wasps, are about 17, 18 millimetres in length. Whereas the worker wasp of this is about 25 millimetres long, which in old money is an inch. And then you have the queens then, which are over 30 millimetres long. And that's fine. What's wrong with that? Why can't we have other wasps? So the reason why we can't, why we're terrified in a way, is because this particular hornet feeds on honeybees, and it can really do a huge amount of damage to the honeybee population. The poor honeybees haven't enough to be putting up with without this. And what these particular hornets do, and they're the only species that do it, is they hang around outside honeybee hives. They wait for the honeybees to come home. They grab them in the air, bite the head off them and suck the guts and middles and beautiful stuff out of the middle of them and bring it off to feed their young with. And because a complete nest of hornets could have up to thousands of workers in it, they can do a huge great deal of depredation. Now, obviously, if you're going to have hornets established in Ireland, we need a queen. We need a queen who's built up a nest. This was a worker wasp. It was obviously arrived in some kind of a package, in some kind of a transport system. She didn't come with all her sisters. It was a female, but she didn't come with all her sisters and her mammy.
Well, we don't know that.
Well,
just one was found.
Just one was found, indeed. But they've looked out. They've put it out an alert. You couldn't miss this if you had half an eye in your head at all. And, you know, people are being asked to keep an eye out for it and send in pictures. It's got an orange face. It's completely black with a yellow third last segment, and its legs are black on top, and it has yellow bottoms to the legs, whereas ordinary wasps have completely yellow legs. But this one has, if you like, black thighs, Derek, and yellow calves, if such a thing could be described, in hornet's legs. And it's really something that we do not want to get established. So if you're, I suppose, if you're getting packets of stuff in from places and they're coming in and you're opening them, I mean, open them carefully. Don't just fire off the wrapping without checking that there isn't any unwanted passengers of any sort in them, because with more and more shopping online, people are getting more and more mm-hmm. packages from everywhere, and who knows what gets into packages inadvertently. And as you're opening them, you have first dibs on getting rid of what's in it if it's not. And really, we don't want anything coming in like this to Ireland, because generally they're invasive species. Generally, they never were intended to be here, and you should not be the vector by which they arrive.
Richard.
Well, now, she is a very nasty character, and the foundress in France came, it seems, in 2005. And it arrived in the UK in 2016, and it's said to move at something like 70 to 80 kilometres per year. So it may come here. It is certainly a real possibility. And if it does, it can wipe out the colony in a beehive in a matter of a day or a few hours even. So we have to be very careful about this beast. But there is a glimmer of hope, it seems to me. The weather here does not suit it, I would have thought. Remember, honeybees have a great solution. They have honey. And if the weather turns bad, they have honey. They won't starve. They will survive through the winter. Hornets have to eat every day or they won't get any. There's no larder at home that they can raid. Now, in the Far East, of course, it's seldom so inhospitable that they can't feed. But here in Ireland, I think a hornet would have a miserable time. It's so much rain and so on and so forth. They probably couldn't. And indeed, the European hornet never came here. Probably for that reason. That's, I'm surmising. We'll have to ask the expert what the real thing is.
The Asian hornet feeds from July onwards, so the nests of the Irish honeybee will be well established by then. And being like any species of wasp, they all die off in the autumn time, and only the queen overwinters, in fact. So their life cycle is attuned to feeding when the honeybees are particularly common. But as you say, we might be very delighted with the rainy, wet summers if that's going to keep the bees from flying around the place. They don't like it in Britain. Anytime it has become established there, they have destroyed the nests and that. So it isn't a permanent feature on the British fauna list. Whenever they get them there, they really make efforts to destroy them. So I can't see really swarms of hornets making it across the Irish Sea under their own steam. I still hold to my opinion that they're going to come packaged in something or travelling and hitchhiking rather than coming under their own steam.
Let's talk now to Rachel Hayden. Rachel is a research assistant at University College Cork. Hello, Rachel. Can you tell me what your interest is in the Asian hornet, please?
Hi, thanks so much for having me on, guys. So I'm working on the Atlantic Positive Project, which is an Interreg international project where we're working with researchers across Europe and the UK to study the Asian hornet and to hopefully stop its spread and minimise its impact in areas where it's already established. So for us in Ireland, I would say we're in a great position because the Asian hornet isn't established here. So we're interested in seeing how likely it is that the Asian hornet can establish in Ireland. We know now that it can arrive in Ireland, but that doesn't mean that it will survive and spread throughout Ireland. As has been mentioned, our weather isn't that great and we mightn't have the same resources that are found in mainland Europe to allow the species to survive here. So that's what we're very interested in. We're also really interested in working with beekeepers because it is a beehive pest in Europe and it can, as we said, wipe out hives. So we're very interested in raising awareness amongst beekeepers and working together.
How do you think it got in here? Would you agree with Ain it possibly came in a package?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think they were looking at the weather patterns, and the wind wasn't really in favour. It's found in southern England at the moment, although I don't know if there's any been any reports this year of any nests or individual sighting. So it couldn't really arrive by flight from England, and especially not from Europe. So more than likely it came in through an import. We have freight ferries coming in every day from France and Spain, especially now because of Brexit. So there's plenty of possibilities and opportunities for the Asian Hornet to just hop on a ferry and arrive in Dublin or Cork or any port really. What happens is that a queen hibernates over winter. So they find a nice warm climate controlled spot somewhere, maybe under the bark of a tree or under the lip of a pot. Sometimes there's whole nests in soil, and they'll overwinter. Then they can spread anywhere. On ferries and ports and cars. They were even found in a tent in the UK that came back from France. And the queens start emerging in spring. So actually just about this time, that's when they start coming out and trying to find a suitable location where they can start their primary nest.
Rachel, you said then they start their nest. So, I mean, we think of ordinary wasps' nests. We are all very familiar with a thing like a golf ball on the roof of the shed. The queen wasp is chewing up timber, making this little, it looks like a paper golf ball on the roof of the shed, lays her 8 eggs, they hatch out, and then they're the workers that increase the size of the paper nest. The paper nest can be other places too, indeed. So what would be typical for a Asian hornet's nest? Would it always be hidden away? Would anyone see the initial stages made by the queen herself? How is the life cycle? Once Mrs. Queen wakens up and decides she's going to make a nest, what's the story from there? Where and how?
The Asian hornet's life cycle is very similar to other wasps and hornets, particularly the European hornet. So when a queen emerges and she's trying to find a nest, usually it's kind of low to the ground, so she doesn't have to use too much energy when creating the nest. It's exactly the same shape as a wasp's one, very small hole at the bottom where she will lay her eggs and then go get some resources. Typically it's near water where she can get the pulp from the tree and make her nest. This can be anywhere. They've been found in garages, they've been found in trees, in hedges. They are also present along the coastline. So really, they're quite adaptable. Queen's nest, the primary nest, is typically very low to the ground, so it is probably easier to see. And then when they move on to the secondary nest, this is a much larger nest. So the queen and workers start creating a much larger nest, sometimes in the same location as the primary one, but typically they'll move a bit higher up, kind of 10 metres or so, in trees or in buildings that are a bit harder to reach and a lot harder to see. You can imagine trying to spot a nest in a forest or amongst tall buildings in a city. They don't stand out that much, but they are quite large in size.
So you're saying the queen makes a small little nest to begin with, gets the show on the road, gets the workers going, and then, like many a person who buys their first house, then decides to trade up and, with the worker wasps, goes off to make a bigger nest then, as you say, more difficult to see. But now, then, should we be worried then? You know, we always getting over the years, we get people writing into the programme, sending us pictures of these kind of nests in their sheds or whatever, and they're wasps nests, ordinary Irish wasps nests, these little paper things that start off. Now the Irish wasps just make the thing bigger and bigger, but we need our Irish wasps. They're part of our biosystem, they're part of our biodiversity, they are a huge control of pests and green flies and aphids and stuff in gardens and crops. So we don't want all-out war and anything that looks like a wasp, because we want to keep the wasps we have. It's just this particular huge one that we don't want. So how can we warn people that there is this problem with the Asian wasp, and yet the other wasps are grand and we want to keep them there, and stop being saying all wasps should go? It's not down with all wasps by any means, is it?
No, it's not. I think that's a real concern since the first Asian hornet was spotted in Dublin, that, you know, there is this fear because it is a hornet. It's a scary looking animal, but that doesn't mean then that we should be kind of going after our native biodiversity, our native wasps and bees and insects that are really important. So I think at this point, it's really vital that we just get to know the Asian hornet and be able to identify it. So the National Biodiversity Data Centre has great resources. If you want to check out the Biodiversity Ireland's website, they have an identification guide and they'll compare it against some of the more common species that we have here. And if you're looking at that primary nest and if you're not too sure if it's a wasp or if it's an Asian hornet, from a distance, have a look, take a picture, report it to the National Biodiversity Data Centre. The queen is quite obvious in a way that she will look quite large. And as you said at the start, orange face, very vibrant yellow legs that really make the Asian hornet stand out. So I think just really important to just become aware of what they look like at this point.
Well, we'll make sure that we have clear pictures on our website and links to the National Parks and Wildlife Service and the National Biodiversity Data Centre, rte.ie/MooneyRichard.
Rachel, I'm a male here and you two are ladies. And of course, we're talking about...
Hold on a second.
Well, Derek, you're the compare.
I'm the bit in the middle.
We're a bit in the middle. Anyway, it's an all-female society, the wasps nest. Males are excluded. They haven't hatched yet. Now, I believe there is a system called worker policing, in which the workers go around and kill anything that hatches that isn't the daughter of the queen. Is that true? And is that true of all wasps? And is it superior to the chemical ways that bees prevent males from coming out? There are genetic ways that bees prevent males coming out.
That's really interesting. I actually haven't heard that to do with the Asian hornet, but I know come late summer, that's when the young females and males start emerging and the females will fly off. Now, there is a lot of research being done from our partners in Europe, and they don't think that the Asian hornets are very territorial, and they actually think that they might work together, where, let's say, an Asian hornet is predating on a hive and gets lost. There is some idea or some belief that they might actually be taken in by another nest. So I'm not too sure if they are very territorial or very predatory when it comes to other nests and come to queens coming into the nest. It would make sense, though, that a queen would displace a potential threat to herself.
We can't really depend on hornets to kill each other and get rid of them in that fashion. And hopefully we won't have two queens who have offspring with different genes. We don't want any queens with any offspring. And in fact, one of the groups that really will be aware of these are the beekeepers. And the Beekeepers Association have put out a website called swarm.ie, which is, they have originally made this website for anyone to contact if they have a swarm of bees that they want someone to take away, or a member of the public sees a swarm of bees and it doesn't know what to do with it. But this swarm.ie is also the site to contact if anyone sees an Asian hornet near a beehive or near a bee's nest. All the eyes are out there. We have citizen scientists keeping an eye, and we don't really want to pray for a wet summer, but if we do have a wet summer, at least that'll be a silver lining, if you like, because it won't be suitable for the Asian hornet.
Well, at least it was spotted. Some eagle-eyed citizen scientist in Dublin spotted this and did the right thing. Rachel, thank you very much indeed. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me on, guys.
Really interesting stuff, I have to say. Now, Aina, here's one for you. The common lizard. You're aware of it, I'm sure?
Yes, the common lizard. The common lizard is the viviparous lizard. And the viviparous lizard is so called because it's alleged to give birth to live young. But this doesn't make it a mammal or anything. The reason why it gives birth to live young is that it holds the eggs inside in it as eggs, and they hatch inside rather than outside in the cold climates. Hence, this lizard is able to live in colder climates than lizards might be expected to live in. And actually, Ireland is the most westerly area where they occur. They can occur up to the Arctic Circle, and easterly as far as Japan. But if you go to other countries, you will see other species of lizards as well. So this is our Irish lizard, and he is sometimes mixed up with the newt. Now, the newt and the lizard look like tiny little dragons, I suppose, and people quite often wonder which one is which. Now, the newt is an amphibian. It lays eggs in water. and they are hatched out. They're not viviparous or anything like that. And they have four toes on their front feet. Whereas a lizard is a scaly reptile. Mm-hmm. It gives birth to live young because it hatches the eggs inside it, and then they are born as little baby lizards.
And lives on land.
And it has five toes on its first legs. So if you get a picture of it and have a look at the toes, you'll know which one is which if you are confused. And don't grab a lizard, whatever you do, Derek, because it loses its tail. It's able to run away and leave its tail in your hand. It's a defence mechanism for it. But lizards need their tails, so stop grabbing at them. You're not a bird.
But can it grow its tail back, Richard Collins?
Well, it partially, not fully, I believe. Interesting that you should say that, because it recently has been shown that the American alligator, when it's young, can replace a lost tail to some extent. So this is a reptile thing in general, but it's a very interesting adaptation. It would have been an idea for mammals if they had retained it, maybe, but they didn't.
Well, Lord, we don't want alligators coming here as well.
Well, let's find out a little bit about them, because UCC is inviting members of the public, that would be you, our listeners, to submit sightings of the elusive common lizard on the Iverra Peninsula in South Kerry, and to better establish just how common the common lizard is in the region. Linda Lyne is the researcher leading this initiative. She's based in Killarney, from where she joins us now. Hello, Linda. How are you today?
I'm very good. I'm very good. How are you?
Great. Tell us about the project.
Yeah, it's really exciting. So we're just starting out, looking for people to start contributing some records from the Iverra Peninsula of our only native reptile, the common lizard.
Linda, I have seen lizards in two completely different habitats. They occur along sandy shores where it's nice and warm and they bask in the sunshine. And I've also seen them on blanket bogs, on stones and rocks that might be there where it's a bit drier. So how can we have lizards in two completely different habitats? Or is that just a Donegal phenomenon? Does that happen in Kerry too?
It does indeed happen in Kerry too, yeah. They're very fascinating animals, the type of habitats you find them in. Firstly, you might not even think that you'd find lizards in areas like bogs that are, you know, wetter habitats, but they do actually do very well there. And then sand dune areas, they've got the vegetation that they need to provide the cover from predators, but also the food and areas where they need to hibernate. You'll also find them in stone walls, and believe it or not, some people are lucky enough to even have them in their gardens, which I'm very jealous of.
Yes, they're actually carnivores, so if you have them around, what they're feeding on are little flies and insects, and like any poor unfortunate carnivore that feeds on these, they have to hibernate for the winter because such food is not available. So then when they come out, being reptiles, they have to get their heat from the environment, they're cold-blooded, hence the basking that they have in the sunshine to warm themselves up, and then they'll stick out their tongues and look for flies and all the rest of it. So it's really chance if you see them or not, in a sense, because they are very sensitive to sound, to shadows, and they'll just whisk away and be gone in a flash. So how do you recommend that people will get records of these for you? And are you worried that they'll mix them up with newts?
Yeah, they are incredibly difficult to see. People do need to be very alert. Their camouflage is fantastic. They can be brown or olive, olive green, and even some black melanistic individuals. And their camouflage is so good, you really need to be looking for them to see them. So instead of trying to find them in thick vegetation, maybe have a look where the vegetation changes. So where heather maybe turns to grass or shorter grass, or the side of footpaths, walking trails as well as a good place. And the stones that you mentioned there as well, where they come out to bask in the sunshine. If it's a thing that you think you see a lizard and it's run off, just wait. They often come back to those same basking spots again. So if you're really patient and lucky, you might get to see them and maybe get a photo. The other species you mentioned there, we only have one newt species in Ireland as well. That's the smooth newt. While they look similar superficially, you know, they're the same body layout. Our common lizards are a little bigger, about 14 centimetres. Newts are only about 10 centimetres. Newts are amphibians, so they have smooth skins, while our common lizards are reptiles and have scales. And if you're very lucky to see one close up, you'll actually notice lizards have five toes on their front feet, while newts only have four. the other thing as well, newts, around this time of year in particular, you'll find them in ponds, and you're unlikely to see lizards in water like that, more so out in the land, moving a bit quicker than newts as well.
Linda, I've seen lizards in various places and the colours can be quite different. Can these little creatures change their colour, or do they have to stick with the colour they inherit at birth?
It's a really good question, because lizards, I've seen them in so many different colours as well. You get them in really amazing bright greens at times. A lot of it can be, you know, helping with their camouflage, but they don't tend to change colour quite quickly like you'd have with maybe chameleons and that. What you'll see is the newborns, which arrive in August, they tend to be a really deep bronze colour. And then as they grow, they'll change into those greens and olives. It's not quite sure if it's linked directly to habitat yet, or if they change colour over their life cycle. That's something that we might even be able to find out through this study, which would be really exciting.
There's a contrast between our lizards. If you go to mainland Europe, you see wall lizards everywhere. They're very common. There are several species and you see them. They're not a bit shy. On the contrary, they're very forthcoming. Whereas our one is as timid as anything, and it's a privilege to actually detect them. They're far more numerous than we think, but we hardly ever see them. Why are they so nervous here when they're so brave elsewhere?
It could be partly to be linked to the fact that our lizards tend to be more in rural areas. So the fact then they don't have many people passing them. You might find maybe the lizards in your garden might be a bit more used to people walking by and a bit braver. But certainly those that you meet out on country walks could disappear very quickly. The lizards that you find maybe on the continent could be more used to people being around, moving into urban areas even. And you'd certainly have things like house geckos and that as well, much more urbanised than our more rural lizards.
Well, Linda, thank you very much indeed. And if you want details on how you can take part in that common lizard survey, visit our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Let's move on. We want to say hello now to Niall Hatch, who's at his home at Greystones. Niall, I have a question for you. Can you tell me, Niall, the last time the common crane, grus grus, bred here in Ireland?
Well, obviously, records going back more than 100 years or so are a bit patchy on these things, but we do know that the crane died out as a breeding species in Ireland just over 300 years ago, and was in decline long before that. But before that, it was a very well-known species. We know that it was kept as a pet by a lot of people, especially the gentry who kept these as a sort of status symbol. They're seen as very loyal pets, and it would have been very familiar in the bogs. A real part of folk culture in Ireland was based around the crane. So it would have been a big loss when it finally vanished from this country.
So if cranes were to breed here again in Ireland, it would be great news.
It would be absolutely wonderful if cranes were to breed here in Ireland again. It would be lovely to have them back. A missing piece of our jigsaw puzzle, I think. That jigsaw puzzle has been damaged. There's lots of missing pieces over the years. To find one more lying under the couch, I think that would be great.
So we'd have to know what we were looking at. So can you describe what a crane looks like for me, please?
So a crane is a really majestic bird. It's very, very tall. So it's really the largest bird that anyone would see in the wild in Ireland if you're lucky enough to come across one. They stand over 4 foot tall. They have a very, very long, long neck, a big bustle at the end of their body as well, this sort of bunch of feathers that hang off the back over their tail, and a big, long, pointed beak. The body is grey. They're black on the face and then down striping onto their neck, and they have a big patch of red bald skin on top of their heads as well. They have a bugling call, the trumpeting call. Often when they're flying, they make that. And when they fly, they keep their neck stretched out in a straight line, unlike a heron, which keeps it held in. So you see this big, looks like a big cross flying through the sky. They're absolutely massive.
And often mistaken for the grey heron here in Ireland, aren't they?
They are often mistaken for the grey heron. The heron actually is often known by people in Ireland as the crane. I think after we lost our real cranes in Ireland, that folk name became transferred to another bird that had long legs, long neck, had a grey body and was found near the water. And a grey heron is a big bird, but the crane is much, much larger. If you saw the two side by side, the grey heron would be dwarfed in comparison. And when the heron flies, it keeps its neck tucked in, almost like an S shape. So you won't really get an idea that this is a very long-necked bird. In flight with the crane, they keep it fully extended, in the same way actually that white storks do too. So that's another bird that would fly with his neck outstretched.
Okay, well, Niall, I hope you're sitting down. Are you sitting down?
I am.
Now,
sitting
Aine, are you sitting down? Well, you are. You're sitting across from me.
There's a chair under the occasion. Yeah. You can't see it.
And Richard, you're sitting down because I've got some good news for you.
You have?
Apparently, cranes have been spotted in Ireland. Not only that, they're breeding, or at least attempting to breed, in Ireland.
Go on.
True, Aine, true. Indeed, the sound of the common crane, which you've been hearing there for the past few moments, is something we could be hearing more of, as a pair are now nesting on a bog in the Midlands. This has been confirmed by Bord na Mona. If breeding is successful, they will be the first common cranes to do so in this country, as Niall has said, for over 300 years. These wetland birds have been extinct here since the 1700s, but are reappearing in numbers in our skies in recent years during migration and overwintering, largely due to conservation efforts in the UK. Bord na Mona's lead ecologist is Mark McCorry. He's based in Ballyroan in County Laois, from where he joins us now. Good news, Mark. Tell us more.
Yeah, well, we've been aware of the cranes now at this particular bog for some time now, Derek. We first were made aware of them last year, and so they went off again. Obviously, they disappeared from the sites, but what was really exciting was that they came back again this spring, and so we've been keeping an eye on them, and they've been building a nest. So far, so good.
There must be great excitement down there. Are the locals aware of their presence?
Well, we've been keeping it under our hat for the time being, Derek. We have, when we first got the news, we notified NBWS, and I'm sure they were very excited and came out to visit the site. So there isn't much local knowledge of this yet, but no doubt, look, that's going to increase. Like, we have been trying to keep the particular site location of the nest, a secret for the moment, just to avoid disturbance. But sure, these birds are so big, they're obvious, you know, so they are going to be seen by people as well.
Can you describe, without giving away the exact location, the habitat in which they've chosen to build their nests?
Well, it's in one of our cutaway bogs, and it's in one of these bogs that where the majority of the peat has been cut away, and this has been re-wet naturally, and it's developed a mosaic of bog cotton and sedges and reeds. And it's a really fantastic wetland habitat that's starting to develop. And we have a lot of this habitat now starting to develop across these bogs. And they just appeared in the corner of this particular bog in a habitat just like that.
And what's the nest like?
It's just a structure of it looks like mostly reeds. It's called a raft, I believe, and it looks from my untrained eye, it looks quite untidy. Obviously, we haven't been too close to the nest. We've been keeping an eye on this nest that they're using. But last year we were able to get closer to the older nest when the birds had left. And, we were really excited to find shell fragments.
But finding shell fragments, did you find any birds? Was it a successful nesting site, do you think?
Well, this is what we don't know. You know, unfortunately, we weren't able to confirm the presence of a chick. And, we do suspect that the birds are juvenile birds. They're quite young. And they're, seemingly young birds, they do feel for several years before they then become successful in relation to breeding. So, look, we would be hopeful. We'd be hopeful this year. Like, what's really exciting is that they're coming back to the same location. And, what's really exciting, when we looked at the nest site last year, we didn't find just one nest, we found two nests. So that seems to indicate that they were even there the year before and no one knew about it.
Richard.
Hello, Mark. I understand from crane people I talk to now and again that they tend to use the same nest year in, year out, and that is the usual practice. Perhaps your second nest was a sort of a trial run or something like that. I don't suppose there's the possible grounds of two pairs nesting.
Well, who knows, Richard? And there is some talk on social media. There has been some sightings of other cranes in the wider Shannon hinterland. So that's not beyond the bounds of possibility that there could be several pairs, using these bogs or using the wider wetlands of the Shannon.
The territory for a crane is very large, about 400 hectares, and the nests tend to be about 5 or 6 kilometres apart, sort of thing. Now, if the crane was to take and was to become established in the Midlands, would there be sufficient cutaway bog and suitable habitat down there? Or rather, put it the other way around, how many crane pairs could the habitat down there possibly support in the future?
Well, sure, look, who knows? Like, if you go out to any of these bogs, they're quite massive, you know. You'd be walking from one side of them to the other. It would take you, half the day. So these are really big bogs. You know, some of them are as big as, like 1,000 to 2,000 hectares in size. And of course, they're scattered from all the way from Longford, along the Shannon. You know, we have bogs in Galway, bogs in Offaly, and bogs in Roscommon. They're widely scattered out, and a lot of these bogs are going to develop these sort of wetland habitats. So there's potential here for a really significant area of habitat, and obviously then, who knows in the future, lots of potential locations where perhaps cranes might colonise.
Well, now, they were very sensitive to disturbance, and one of the things that drove them out, I mean, these were pets in the old days and loved by everybody. The crane is still loved. Remarkably, cranes are very popular everywhere you go, not just this species, but other species as well. Yet, the poor things, they were eaten, of course, to some extent anyway, but yet they decided to go. They couldn't put up with the disturbance of the hunting and the habitat destruction. Now, is there sufficient seclusion down where this nest is to prevent anything like that undermining the performance?
This particular bog, this particular site, it's very secluded. It's nice and quiet at the moment. This bog has been out of peat production for some time, or this particular section. Now, what's interesting is that they are close to the boundary. And obviously we have adjacent land, we have farmland, we have some forestry as well. So while it's very secluded, you do have these other land uses ongoing in the wider area, in relation to farming and so on. So we'll just have to wait and see, really, in terms of the potential level of disturbance and what that might, what impact that might have.
Cranes were a wonderful part of the landscape long ago, because the Irish word for crane is Cor, and there are an awful lot of place names called after them, Corclock, Corbally, all over the place. So presumably they were a very widespread species, and there was an awful lot of habitat that actually suited them, because otherwise why would the places be called after them? So it seems that it's a huge change that we have great celebrations because one pair have come back. Surely we haven't destroyed the entire amount of wetty places where they would have been breeding before. Do you fear, because they're ground nesting birds, that they'll go the way of the corncrake, they'll go the way of the curlew before they even get started?
Well, that's a good point. And sure, we know about the issues of curlew, and unfortunately the issues then when the population has shrunk so much, they're very prone to disturbance by predators. And unfortunately, in all of these areas, we have, grey crow, we have the fox, we have the mink, etc., etc. So there are those pressures, and particularly, when we only have, some pairs, they're going to be quite vulnerable. Those pressures are always going to be there. Like, hopefully, this particular area, it's a wetland area. Like, you would really need your waders to get into it. So hopefully it's protected to some degree from some of these predators, but look, we know that all these ground nesting birds, lapwing would be the same. Like, we go out on the cutaway and sure, we see lapwing, and then you see the grey crow sitting perching, looking, waiting for the lapwing to move as well. So unfortunately, there are those pressures there.
Mark, I know that there'll be people listening to us now who are hearing us talking about cranes and are saying to themselves, well, I see cranes all the time. I didn't know that they were rare. And of course, in Ireland, a lot of people know the bird called the grey heron by the name the crane. I think it's a sort of a folk memory of the crane that we lost, the true crane. How could people tell them apart? And what's the best way to identify a real crane?
I agree. And it's interesting, you know, talking to my dad and just talking to him about this, like he would call the heron a heron crane, you know, and we're from originally from County Antrim. And yeah, like, you know, where did that come from? And you do suspect it is a legacy of the fact that the crane was originally here in Ireland. The crane is a much bigger bird. It stands quite tall. I was talking to my colleague Alex Copeland, and he described it as almost like standing like an ostrich with a big bustle. It's quite obvious. Now, I've only seen the one crane. I actually seen it several years ago in a different bog during the winter time. It was very clear that it was a very big bird, you know, and sure, it has a big long neck like the heron when it stands up and straightens its neck. So it's very obvious, and it has a big long and wide wingspan as well. So if we start to see more cranes, people will get more familiar with them, and it'll be quite obvious that this is a quite different species.
Now, this must be a big deal for Birdwatch Ireland, I'm thinking.
Oh, it is absolutely, because it's really good to see a species that was lost starting to come back. And this is very encouraging, because we're obviously always talking about doom and gloom and the species that we've lost and the species that are on the way out. So when something bucks the trend and comes back in, this is a really encouraging sight. And the fact as well that these cutaway bogs that had been damaged so badly, that they're actually now being used again as wildlife habitat, and that they're being able to support such an interesting and beneficial species, I think that that's really important. We've also seen, of course, that the cranes have been recovering across the water in Britain. There's a growing population in England, and indeed also in Scotland now as well, where these birds have been able to recolonize. There's also been some reintroduction there. And one of the theories there is perhaps climate change has enabled them to get a toehold again in England. Maybe we're seeing the knock-on benefits of that here in Ireland too, as that British population expands. Maybe they're coming into us here in Ireland. And of course, as the ecosystem comes back and these cranes do better, and hopefully they'll breed successfully and produce more cranes that will then return again to breed themselves, that again is going to then create habitat that's good for other creatures too. So hopefully we'll see knock-on benefits for birds like snipe, hopefully for curlew, grey partridge maybe. I know another one that has benefited a lot from Bord na Mona's work in recent years at Loch Borra. So I'm hoping that, yes, it's a sign of things to come and that we may be getting this species back at long last.
Niall, if you look across the water to Sussex and Surrey respectively, a number of private landowners are helping to establish a breeding population of what they're calling free-living white storks in Britain once again. Is it possible that we could do something similar here with cranes? I know there has been some kind of discussion about a reintroduction program. Do you know anything about that?
Well, certainly that's something that's been discussed, and certainly reintroduction can be a very valuable tool when a species isn't going to come back of its own accord. So a very good example of that was the reintroduction of the white-tailed eagle, the golden eagle and the red kite. They were large birds of prey that are reluctant, we know, to cross water. So when they left Ireland, as an island, of course, when they were wiped out, that meant that they were very unlikely to come back without human assistance. Now, cranes are better at flying over water. They're a big bird that likes to soar, but they do have long migration routes. We know that a lot of them come down from Scandinavia. They pass through France and they go to southern Europe, places like Spain. They're well able to fly over long distances. And we know that they can reach Ireland because we have in recent years been seeing an increase in the number of cranes in the autumn and the winter passing through. I remember seeing a flock of the five of them together down at a site in Wexford a few years ago. So that was an amazing sight. And so we know that they know Ireland is there, and they have been increasing in numbers here. So it may be that reintroduction isn't necessary. It's always better if the birds can do it by themselves. And if these cranes are starting to expand in, they're finding these re-wetted bogs to be to their liking, well, hopefully they'll do it by themselves, and therefore nature will take its course and humans won't have to intervene. I think it should only be done as a last resort.
I would absolutely concur with what Niall has said. Like, this is really exciting, and it's just another indicator of the fantastic biodiversity potential of these re-wetted cutaways. And for me, look, I consider myself a botanist, and I'm generally looking at the ground, you know, and looking at all the lovely plants and so on. But it's fantastic to get these other animals, these fantastic birds, to come back.
Did you get any images of them?
Yeah, we were lucky, you know, some of my colleagues were out and they took some fantastic photos just with the camera and, the telescope. We were afraid to get too close, but it's, you know, hopefully at some stage, who knows, we will be able to come down to places like Loughborough Discovery Park and go and look at the cranes.
Mark, thank you very much indeed. And we wish you the very best of luck. And hopefully these birds will breed this year and that they will produce offspring.
Absolutely. Sure. Thanks very much.
It would be fantastic to think that you could go along to a bog and from a distance look on a screen and see the birds while they're nesting, just as they do with the ospreys in the Highlands in Scotland. What do you think about that, Niall? Wouldn't it be good?
I think it's a brilliant idea. I think that anything that can make nature more real to people, that people see this in real time, it can work wonders. And it's a way to do that without disturbing the birds themselves. Because when they're nesting, of course, they're very sensitive. Those ospreys that you mentioned at Aviemore, at Lochgarten, that the RSPB have put their cameras on up in Scotland for many years now, that's the classic example of that. A way that generations of school children have been able to see those birds up close, see how they live without any human interference, without any risk to the chicks. It's been really clever. And the fact is, because cranes are so spectacular and so large, I think getting a camera on them would be easy enough, actually, and people would be able to see lots of activity on the screen. So I'm all for that.
Yeah, Niall, they wouldn't have to crane their necks looking at them, sure they wouldn't.
Oh, very good. Very good.
Derek, I would be very much in favour of that, because the crane is at its best when it's courting. It does the most elaborate courtship dance, a kind of walking like soldiers, leaping into the air and crying out and flapping the wings. It is an extraordinary, a rather ridiculous sight. I've seen it once or twice, and it's slightly ridiculous, but it is absolutely endearing. So that aspect of it is very important. And another interesting thing about cranes is that they produce two chicks. And as the chicks mature, the parents adopt a chick each and they go their separate ways. So this sort of thing is very interesting. Of course, they're at their best when they fly. Cranes look ridiculous on the ground. They're enormous, skinny things, Giacometti-like sculptures. But they have this big, bushy tail, disorganized mass of feathers sticking out of their rear ends. But when they fly, they are so elegant. And you and I, Derek, have been to the Bosphorus, trying to see the cranes crossing over on the Great Migration, hoping to see the great V formations of cranes. Very regular formations, beautifully done. We were unlucky on the Ibis there twice, and I was unlucky both times. But it is a great sight to see these skeins going down to Africa or coming back from Africa, as the case may be. And it's a rather curious thing, because these flocks flying apparently keep an eye on other flocks miles away, and the whole thing is a kind of coordinated migration. The crane is altogether a wonderful creature. And you mentioned the red cap. There's an illustration in the Book of Kells of a long-legged marsh bird, and it has a red cap. So the monks back then had recognised cranes.
Yeah, Richard, as if human courtship behaviour wasn't ridiculous. As he was without sins, cast the first stone.
Well, as they say, God wasn't entirely serious when he invented sex, you know.
Niall?
Very hard to follow up on that, but I do.
I was going to say, I shouldn't have put you on the spot like that, Niall. I was going to say, you've seen these cranes in Japan. Well, not these ones, but you've seen cranes in Japan.
I have. I've seen the several species in Japan, but the classic one is the Japanese crane, or the red-crowned crane, which is one of the natural symbols of Japan. It's actually been declared a national monument over in Japan for the natural world.
National monument?
Yes, absolutely. Japan declares some of these things of cultural significance as being these natural or national monuments. And there's the northernmost island of Japan, Hokkaido. In the summer months, you get the cranes there breeding and doing their dancing. They don't migrate away. They stay there year round. The Japanese cranes are a bit bigger than these common cranes in Europe, if you could believe that. They stand about 5 foot tall, and they're beautiful white instead of grey. They have black as well on the head, and they have this red patch on the crown as well. They do these elaborate dances. I think the reason why they've been seen as so sacred to the Japanese for many centuries is because of their faithfulness. They're seen as mating for life and being very faithful to their partners, and that this is something that should be emulated by humans, and it's something to be very much admired. And what really surprised me in that part of Japan was that although that the species is very rare because it nearly went extinct because of habitat loss there, in that area of Hokkaido where they preserve them, what they do is the farmers put out food for them. They become a great source of income to the local area because of all the photographers and birdwatchers who want to see them. And the cranes have no fear of people whatsoever. So you're with these wild animals that are standing over 5 foot tall. There might be 100 of them in front of you, and they're maybe 2 or 3 meters away. They really have no fear of people whatsoever. And it was really interesting to me to see how respected they were, how people did not cross the boundary, how people did not harass them. There really was genuine respect. And I think that's something that you see a lot in Japanese culture. So I was delighted to see that. And then in other parts of Japan, you have a wonderful place called Izumi. It's down in southern Japan on the island of Kyushu. And in the winter months there, you have a huge migration of cranes from all over Asia from many different species. There's 4 different species of crane all go to this one crane center. So anyone ever finds themselves in Japan in the future, I would definitely recommend going to the crane center in Izumi.
You don't have to go all the way to Japan. Can't you see them in Europe? Can't you see big flocks of them in Europe too?
You can, absolutely. And I remember as a child, one of my main birding memories, I was with my dad on holidays in France. And we went to a place in the middle of France, which is well known for this big migration of cranes coming down from Scandinavia, probably heading down to Iberia. This is the common crane, the one we're talking about here from the Bordenamona bogland. And I'd never seen them before, and I wanted to get them from my list. And it was a very cold, snowy day. We'd driven a long distance to come see them down from Paris, where my dad lived at the time. And what we did was we went to this place where the guidebook said to go. A place called Lac du Der is the name of the place, and I couldn't see any. I was very disappointed. It was blowing a blizzard, and I just saw all these hedgerows, and I heard all of these school children making loads of noise. And it was several minutes later that I realized, when the blizzard cleared, that they weren't hedges. They were hundreds of cranes all standing in a row, and that they weren't school children. They were cranes all bugling and calling and greeting each other as they flew in, and it blew my mind. I remember then seeing my first ever white-tailed eagle came in, and it was trying to hunt one of the cranes. It'd be a big meal even for an eagle. And the cranes all scattered and went up with the biggest noise I'd ever heard. And it was absolutely astonishing. So that's something. Imagine even seeing that, even on a smaller scale in Ireland, in the Midlands. That would be phenomenal.
Now, a lot of people will be familiar with the term bucket list, things they must do before they pop their clogs. Niall, I know you've got a bird list. You refer to it there, your list. There are 450 birds on the Irish bird list. How many are on the international worldwide bird list? And how many have you clocked up on yours?
Worldwide, I have seen just over 3,000, about 3,500, I think, birds around the world. There's about 10,000 species on the planet, so there's a long way to go, and I probably won't get all of them. But the most important thing, of course, with birds is to enjoy them for what they are. You don't have to tick them off a list. You can just enjoy watching them, immersing yourself in them. And I honestly get as much of a kick out of watching new behaviour from, say, a blackbird or a robin in my own garden as I do from ticking a new species off my list. It genuinely is.
But you still have the list, Niall. Come on. Don't.
Oh, I do, and I keep it on my spreadsheet on my computer. And I keep it on my spreadsheet and my computers, and I do all of that. Absolutely. And I know there are a lot of birders out there who keep lists, and keeping your Irish list is a big thing for a lot of birders. But I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact, though, that birds are amazing in their own right. And if you don't know the names of them, it doesn't really matter. Just enjoy them for what they are.
Richard Collins, do you have a bird list?
No, I don't. But I, way back, decided I wasn't going to start this stamp collecting approach to birds. I thought that it's an aesthetic experience. It's an ornithological experience. The person who comes to mind is one Phoebe Schnetzinger. Phoebe Schnetzinger was a New York stockbroker who worked in the financial industry. And she went to her doctor with a tumour. And she said, I've very bad news for you, Phoebe. You will last about 15 months. So Phoebe, the poor Phoebe, was very upset. She went home. She resigned from her job and headed off to see every bird in the world, every bird species in the world. 18 years later, she was in a minibus in Madagascar, had seen one of the rarest birds she'd ever seen, and she was going to see another very rare one. when the minibus went off the road.
Oh dear.
And poor old Phoebe was killed. Nobody else in the bus was injured except Phoebe, and she was killed. Now, she'd clocked up something like 8,300 species seen, and she skipped her daughter's wedding just to go out and see a rare bird that showed up the night before. Anyway, Phoebe was some character.
She certainly was. My thanks to Richard Collins, Aidan Ilana and Niall Hatcher. Broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland and our researcher is John Bella Riley. Before we go, I want to tell you that you can hear us live next Sunday on RT Radio 1 and for 4 weeks after that from 6 p.m. Talk to you then. Bye-bye!
Mooney Goes Wild is presented and produced by Derek Mooney.